From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The life and career of Bill Russell and the development of the NBA during Russell's 13-year career with the Boston Celtics as both player and coach is the subject of a new book called King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. The author, Aram Godzouzian, is an assistant professor of history at the University of Memphis, and he has also written about Sidney Poitier, and he's my guest this week. Aram Godzouzian, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Gary.
Bill Russell, he has more championship rings than he has fingers.
That's true.
So what does he do? Does he wear one on his toe?
I don't know that he has rings from the time. I have seen him in pictures where he's holding a big collection of rings. Yeah, Russell is really the greatest winner in the history of American team sports. He has a record that really doesn't compare with anybody else in terms of just sheer number of championships.
It's pretty incredible. Now, while he wasn't the first African American to play professional basketball, Bill Russell was sort of a Jackie Robinson to the sport. What did professional basketball look like when Russell came into the sport, and how did it change during his years as a player?
Well, as I write in the book, Bill Russell didn't desegregate the NBA. He wasn't the first black player, but he, in some ways, integrated the NBA. And in that regard, he's very much like Jackie Robinson. The NBA, when he arrived, was almost entirely white. There were a few black players on most of the teams. Most of them were role players, and they were even those who had the skills to be really stars were almost very conscious about how they adapted their games to not sort of step out of their place. Russell was really the first African American superstar in the NBA. He was the first to become a major drawing card, both at home and especially on the road. Wherever he went in his rookie year, they tended to draw huge crowds. He was the first African American who really made his team a champion. And he was the first African-American basketball player who really spoke out on racial issues. In some ways, he was a groundbreaking athlete in general, in terms of understanding the African-American athlete.
Well, what was the game like before him?
In terms of the style of the game, that's one of Russell's greatest innovations. It was primarily an earthbound game. Most players relied still on two-handed set shots, or even if they were shooting with one hand, the jump shot was still a relatively recent innovation. And the goal of the game had really been to try to get, close enough to get a layup. And Russell, what his greatest innovation was on the defensive end. He leaped to block shots, and he had impeccable timing, incredible athleticism, and also really a fierce intelligence. The way that he studied players and understood their habits, and even psyched out particular opponents, was an important component of his game. So in a lot of ways, he erased the easy layup from the NBA. Once he brought his defense into the league, it forced opponents to become more well-rounded in their game, more athletic, to shoot from mid-range and from long-range. It brought the game up into the air, in other words.
A fierce intelligence. So what kind of a person was he before he got into basketball? Was he well-educated?
Russell is a fascinating person, and extremely smart, in some ways almost self-taught. He grew up in his early years in West Monroe, Louisiana, quite poor, and his family moved during World War II to Oakland with the job opportunities that originated during World War II. He lost his mother at a young age. His mother died when he was 12 years old. And Bill was the second son. His older brother, Charlie, was an amazing athlete and very well-rounded and gregarious. Bill was much more introspective, much more shy. A lot of his... he found a lot of value in books and in solitary time and in thinking. Even at an early age, he would describe things such as taking out art books and trying to memorize a Leonardo da Vinci painting in his mind. He had that kind of mind. He was also very sensitive, especially his mother dying made him turn inward to a great extent. So he took slights and he sort of built them up, and then it came out in his basketball play especially. And the other thing about Russell is he wasn't really a great athlete when he was very young. He didn't really develop fully as a basketball player until his senior year of high school, and even after he had graduated in senior year of high school, he graduated on the half year, and he only got one college scholarship offer from the University of San Francisco. But he developed so quickly after high school that he transformed his college team. The University of San Francisco teams that he played on were among the best in college basketball history. In his junior and senior year, they went on a 55-game winning streak, won two NCAA titles.
And then he played in the Olympics also.
He did. In one 13-month period, from 1955 through 1956, he won the second of his NCAA titles, an Olympic gold medal, and an NBA championship in his rookie year. In some ways, that's the most astonishing of his accomplishments.
It really is. We're talking with Aram Ghosusian, and his book is called King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. So how did he become a pro player then?
The way that he ended up on the Boston Celtics was actually, it's a very interesting story in that at the time, the NBA was relatively small potatoes. Its critics called it a bush league. And there were only eight teams in the NBA. None played west of the Mississippi River. The furthest south was St. Louis. And Russell, being on the West Coast, had only come to the East Coast as a college player once during a tournament in Madison Square Garden. So even though he was recognized as the greatest college basketball player of his time, there was a lot of doubts about Russell. There hadn't really been a player like him, a guy who was primarily made his name on the defensive end, who leaped to block shots, who wasn't a skilled all-around shooter and dribbler and passer the way some of the other great college players of the time were. So there were some who thought he would be a bust. Some who thought that he would have to adjust his game when he got to the NBA, would get pushed around by a lot of the bulkier centers in the NBA. And so there were a lot of doubts about whether he would be great. Red Auerbach of the Boston Celtics was convinced that Russell was the last piece he needed to build a championship team. All he wanted was a guy who could defend and rebound, because he had an amazing backcourt. He had Bob Cousy and Bill Sharman, who were probably the best passer and the best shooter of their eras. And so he threw a very complicated a series of trades, negotiations. He was able to move his pick from the seventh pick in the NBA draft to the second pick, and sort of guaranteed that the first pick wouldn't be, that Rochester, who had the first pick, wouldn't take Russell. And through this complicated means, he was able to secure Russell. Then he had to make sure that Russell wouldn't sign with the Harlem Globetrotters. And the Harlem Globetrotters at the time, right up until Bill Russell, had always signed the premier black talent. And when Russell signed with the NBA, it was a signal of where the Globetrotters were heading, as sort of a comic sideshow, as comic entertainment, rather than the premier outlet for black basketball talent.
So the Harlem Globetrotters were more of a serious team at that time?
You know, they engaged in clowning and had been doing so since the 1940s, you know, the various routines that they did. But it was also where most black players found more opportunity. It paid better than the NBA, although you were touring a lot more. And the opportunities in professional basketball, in the NBA and its precursors, were very limited for black players. So it was only very gradually that black players were breaking into the NBA. And the NBA owners were also really resistant to pluck away players from the Globetrotters, because the Globetrotters were a huge commercial draw. A lot of the times the way NBA owners made their money was when they staged a doubleheader where the Globetrotters played first.
Hmm.
So they didn't want to alienate Abe Saperstein, who was the owner of the Globetrotters, by plucking away too much of his talent. But with the civil rights movement burgeoning, with players like Russell coming onto the scene, it really started to change the way that the Globetrotters were perceived, and started to change. And with the NBA growing, it changed the way the NBA was perceived as well, moving from this sort of bush league image into really a big league image.
So, you know, it was almost a decade after Jackie Robinson, and Jackie Robinson, of course, encountered a lot of racism when he joined the major leagues in, mm-hmm. with the Brooklyn Dodgers. What kind of racism did Bill Russell encounter, if any?
In a lot of ways, very similar treatment. He probably got more of it than some of his black contemporaries, simply because of his notoriety. You know, he would hear the racial slurs that Jackie Robinson heard, that other black players heard. He would face, especially in St. Louis, which is sort of the most southern city in the NBA, there were places that refused to serve black players. When there were exhibition games, they would go play in small towns and tour throughout various cities, and there were places that refused to serve the black players. There was an incident in Charlotte, North Carolina. There was another incident in the early 1960s in Kentucky. The one in the early 1960s is sort of an instructive instance. It was supposed to be a tribute game for Frank Ramsey, one of Russell's teammates, and Cliff Hagan, who played for the St. Louis Hawks. They'd both been University of Kentucky stars. And this was going to be a preseason exhibition game in Lexington, Kentucky. Before the game, the hotel refused to serve a couple of Russell's black teammates at the coffee shop there. So Russell engineered a walkout of all of the black players who were supposed to participate in the game. And he used this as a way to say, you know, that athletes can take a stand against segregation just as the Freedom Riders were doing around the same time, just as the students were doing it with their sit-ins. This is the way that athletes could at least bring awareness to these issues and show that they don't belong in the fabric of American society.
Well, you said something, and I wish I had written down exactly what you said, but you said something about how as a player, when he was first rising up as a player, that he didn't play like other players because he sort of stepped a little bit out of the of his place as a player.
Mm-hmm.
I, sort of what you said. And I guess that's kind of one of the issues of racism in America, too, that black people were not staying in their place.
Yeah, he was an innovator, not just in what he did on the court, but in the way that he represented himself off of the court. Once he started to get media attention, Russell was very conscious of, A, not fulfilling any black stereotypes, and not to be seen as clowning, laughing, joking, especially, but B, being considered as an individual, not just playing into sort of the iconic role that someone like Joe Louis or Jesse Owens or even Jackie Robinson was forced into early in his career, sort of the humble, dignified black hero. Rather, he wanted people to consider him as a complex individual. He was willing to air his thoughts. He was willing to talk about what made him unique. He didn't fall into any... He wasn't easy to identify into one political category, for instance. He was a guy who certainly supported the civil rights movement. At the same time, in the early 1960s, when it was very unpopular to do so for any black public figure, he was defending the Nation of Islam. He was defending Malcolm X and saying, you know, they bring an added dimension to how we understand black freedom. There were few athletes who were willing to do that. Even before Muhammad Ali was Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell was doing this. That's not to say that he was a member of the Nation of Islam or that he was a black radical in the sense of how it would be perceived in the late 1960s, because he was also a man who spoke to white people. He was a man who, many of his best friends, the godfather of his children was one of his white friends from the Boston area. He had a very enriching enriching relationships with his white teammates, with his coach, Red Auerbach, and especially as the Celtics got perceived as this, as sort of the NBA's great emblem of racial integration, black and white players working together, winning championship after championship, and Russell was the leader of this. So people had to listen to his views on race, because here was a guy who could speak to both whites and blacks and teach them all something, I guess.
And in the city of Boston, where there was so much unrest about busing and so forth.
Yeah, in a city that was notorious for sort of, not a Southern-style racism, but rather maybe an ethnic white resentment against blacks, and particularly in its sports culture. The many members of the media were openly racist. Some were quite hostile to Russell, and he had very bad relationships with a number of them.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Aram Ghosusian, and he's the author of a fine new book about Bill Russell called King of the Court. Was Russell an angry man? What kind of a person was he? Is he?
His close friends will tell you that he is a warm, gregarious, generous person. Many people would say that he's extremely thoughtful, that he is introspective, that he values friendship, and while he doesn't make a broad circle of friends, if you are his friend, he gives you everything that you would ask of a friend. But he also had what, you know, Bob Cousy called it a Jekyll and Hyde relationship in terms of his private and his public dimensions. When he was with his teammates, he very much valued the locker room and his teammates as sort of a cocoon from the outside world, which he often perceived as hostile to him and racist. But when he stepped out into the outside world, he kind of put on a mask, a very sort of stony glare. He could be openly rude to people. He could very much be a jerk to someone just coming up to him to stir up a conversation. He refused to sign autographs, which he saw as sort of a demonstration of celebrity worship, and he didn't want to be just considered a celebrity. He wanted to be considered a person. He refused to just write his name for someone because he didn't think it made sense. But the way that that translated into public action was simply ignoring someone. So there's no easy way to answer what is Bill Russell's personality or what was Bill Russell's personality, because he acted very differently in very different contexts. Much of it was a response to his earlier years when he was so shy and when he was so introspective. And he took so much value from what sports brought him, and especially what his teammates brought him in terms of a safety net, if you will. But he also was such a sensitive individual that every slight, every insult against him, he buried it deep inside him, and it really bothered him in a way where some of his black teammates could simply shrug them off. He could never shrug them off.
Well, this year, the Los Angeles Lakers beat the Boston Celtics in the NBA Finals. It was a perfect time to be reading your book.
Mm-hmm.
How did that rivalry, that great rivalry between those two teams, develop?
It is one of the interesting stories in the Boston Celtics dynasty is the way that their main rival keeps evolving. In the early years, it's very much the St. Louis Hawks. It's later the Philadelphia Warriors that had, especially when Wilt Chamberlain joined them in the early 1960s. But the Los Angeles Lakers become their opponent in the finals, I believe it's 8 times over the course of Russell's era. And some would say it's not really a rivalry because the Celtics won every time in the 1960s. If it wasn't for the Boston Celtics, the Lakers of the 60s would have been considered one of the great all-time teams. And it's a rivalry that really got its start in 1962, which was one of the greatest NBA series played of all time. This was a year when Elgin Baylor missed a huge chunk of the season because of military duty. It was, I believe, his third or fourth year and Jerry West's second year. And Jerry West had really blossomed into a superstar in this year, and they became really a great 1-2 scoring punch. It is a series that went to 7 games at Boston Garden. If a man named Frank Selvey had hit a 15-foot jump shot at the buzzer, the Lakers would have won the NBA championship that year. And a lot of people were saying at the time, one of the Celtics was anonymously quoted as saying, if we lose the championship this year, I think this is the end of an era. I think the Lakers will start to take over. They're the younger team. They have the more dynamic team. But the Celtics started to reorient their team, started to become more, they revolved less around Bob Cousy, more around Bill Russell, and really became a more defensively oriented team after this. So they evolved in some ways into almost a different team. Russell was still at the center, but the pieces around him had kind of changed. Meanwhile, the Lakers had this great 1-2 punch in West and Baylor. And every year they got close, but every year they didn't have the dynamic center to counteract Russell. And over the course of a number of close calls, Celtics kept winning. Until 1969, that was the year when, '68-'69, that was the year that the Lakers acquired Wilt Chamberlain, Russell's greatest rival as an individual. So it combined all of the great rivals into one team. And this is sort of the climactic end to Russell's career. 1969, the Celtics finished in fourth place. They were old team. No one expected much from them. And they went all the way to the NBA Finals, and they beat the Lakers in 7th game. They vanquished all their old rivals in terms of West, Baylor, and Chamberlain.
And Russell was also the coach of the Celtics?
That's an extraordinary part of the story that I feel sometimes gets ignored in how people think about Bill Russell. For his last 3 seasons, he was the player coach of the team, and they won 2 more NBA titles in those 3 years. He was, in a lot of ways, he adopted the system that Red Auerbach had set up. But he also was very much, you know, this is a guy who was playing virtually the entire game all the time. And he very much relied on his teammates. In a lot of ways, created a very, even further, the democratic culture that existed among the Boston Celtics and turned that to their advantage. If we look a lot of times for sort of precursors in terms of black leadership and people who were looked upon as leaders in this era. And Russell has to be considered among them. He was the first African-American to be a coach in any major professional sports league.
And did he participate in your book? What does he do now?
Russell did not participate in the book. I did interviews with about 50, almost 50 people, including a lot of his old teammates, both in San Francisco and with the Celtics, a number of his rivals, including Jerry West and Al Attles. a number of his friends, the godfather of his children, neighbors, relatives. But Russell is a notoriously private individual, and he has his own projects that he supports. When I started writing the book, I never expected to get Russell's cooperation. And I did my due diligence, you know, I contacted his assistant a number of times and wrote letters to him through the Retired Players Association, and never heard back. But on the other hand, if you're not going to get a cooperation from anyone, in some ways Russell is an okay person to not get cooperation from, because he's written especially two really great memoirs. One in 1966 called Go Up for Glory, and the other published in 1980 called Second Wind. And they're both just extraordinary for different reasons. Go Up for Glory really stands out as a groundbreaking memoir. It was the first memoir by an athlete that really attacked the culture of racism that existed in the United States. That wasn't just a local boy makes good story. And then Second Wind, which is published in 1980, is probably the best sports book of all time, in my opinion, in just that it's so beautifully written. It's written with Taylor Branch, who later is, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. And it's just very introspective, very gracefully written, very thoughtful about what sport means and also who Russell was as an individual. It's out of print now, but you can still find used copies. I'd encourage your listeners to go and buy a copy if they could.
Once they've exhausted the King of the Court, Bill Russell, and the Basketball
League. Of course.
You've also written about Sidney Poitier, the actor, whose career parallels Russell's almost exactly, only in Hollywood rather than basketball. So when you wrote this book, you just had to change a couple of things. Basically the same book.
Not really, unfortunately. Poitier's career is very much interesting in its own right. In a lot of ways, the context for the two public figures is very much the same. The real difference is that Poitier, as a movie star, has to remain very conscious of a public presentation of himself. And in a lot of ways, he comes to believe in that public presentation of himself as sort of the perfect integrationist, if you will. Really, the white liberal's dream of what a black person should be like, in a lot of ways. He becomes his movie character. And Russell is so interesting in that he is so conscious of not being an icon. He is so conscious of not being an image. He always wants to be considered as an individual, as a complex person. I don't know of any other public figure in American life who's ever been so prominent, yet so resistant to being categorized as one thing.
Well, of course, to my knowledge, Sidney Poitier never played in the NBA, but Bill Russell did become an actor, a very successful actor.
It's true. He was he moved to Los Angeles after his playing career, and he acted in a number of television programs. He constantly appeared on talk shows. He hosted his own both radio show and television show. Was in a movie. He really was interesting because in the 1970s, when a lot of people were complaining about sort of the plastic nature of American life and saw public figures as corrupt or as unauthentic, and especially with the Watergate scandal brewing, Russell was this guy who had always sort of stood for what he believed was right and had this sort of image as an authentic person, as someone who stood up for what he believed in. So when he took that into L.A., into celebrity culture, it sort of gave him a credence that other people didn't have. He actually was a really valued spokesman in terms of advertising in the 1970s. There's a great quote from an executive from AT&T who says, "He's a strange guy. He doesn't endorse something unless he believes in it." Which sounds a little strange, but really speaks to how he was sort of seen as this paragon of authenticity.
So even at his height as a sports figure, he didn't do a lot of advertising for products as sports
figure? Not much. And some of that actually was due to the fact that the black athletes often didn't receive the same considerations to do promotions as white athletes did. Or if they were asked to do an ad, would be asked to do it at union scale as opposed to paying them what a celebrity would get. So he didn't do many endorsements during his playing career. But after that, in some ways it helped him in his post-playing career earn money because he was sort of seen as someone who wouldn't just sell his name for nothing.
Well, Aram Gudsousian, you're not an African-American, and yet you've written these two books about these interesting African-Americans. What draws you to this particular personality?
That's a good question. I teach African American history, and I teach it at the University of Memphis, which is a school that is has a very high percentage of African Americans in it. So I have many African American students, and it's sort of become what I study and what I'm interested in. But at the same time, I don't feel like I study to the exclusion of other aspects of American history. I keep getting drawn back into topics that involve African American history because I'm interested in the question of what it means to be an American, I think, more broadly. And I think that African American history gives us this really interesting lens into that. In a lot of ways, it holds a mirror to America, and it allows us to see both the progress that we made as a nation and our hypocrisies over time. And African Americans, in a lot of ways, their experience reflects so many aspects of what it means to be an American, from our political system and what democracy means to popular culture. And the figures that I've written about are really popular culture figures. And African Americans have been so influential in that part of our world. They've become representatives of the United States, the broader world.
Do you have an idea then who will be your third subject for your next biography?
I've actually started to research and even wrote a little of a new book that is not a biography and is not a popular culture study. It is about a civil rights march. It's about a march called the Meredith March Against Fear. It started here in Memphis in June of 1966 by James Meredith, the man who had integrated the University of Mississippi in 1962. And on the second day of his march, he got shot. He survived, but he was wounded. And major civil rights organizations descended upon Memphis to continue his march down to Jackson. And this is the march that became famous for the slogan Black Power. That's the first time that it was introduced on a large scale. And the debates over Black Power in a lot of ways are one of the interesting stories of this march. But I'm also trying to bring out the fact that this march was about a lot more than Black Power. It was about registering voters and about debates over American democracy and about some really how the institutions of Mississippi were adjusting to the Civil Rights Revolution and how the Voting Rights Act was really starting to change what Mississippi looked like. And also some very dramatic instances of both brutality and really inspiring stories as well along the march.
Well, that sounds interesting. I hope you'll come back and talk to us about that when you're finished with that project.
I'd love to. Thanks.
This book that we're talking about is called King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. And the author, Aram Godsousian, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I do hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back again and join us again next time. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thank you, Breanne. And I also want to thank our guest, Aram Godsousian, author of King of the Court, Bill Russell, and the Basketball Revolution, for being my guest this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. See you next time.